Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the Ohio Supreme Court agreed to consider whether plaintiffs have standing to challenge the constitutionality of Governor John Kasich's privatized job development agency's use of liquor profits, state liquor profits, as a funding stream. Jobs Ohio has operated since 2011 on private donations, the amount of which remains secret, and on a $1 million appropriation from the Ohio General Assembly. Joining us to talk about the issue is Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
Good morning.
Hi, Karen. And also joining us to help us understand how you translate liquor profits into a funding stream for a job development agency is OSU Law Professor Paul Rose. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Good morning.
So how this is not a ruling on the constitutionality of the funding stream for Jobs Ohio. This is about standing. Karen, what has been the objection to standing in the past? I know there's been a district court and a common pleas court have both thrown it out.
We've got this original lawsuit filed by Progress Ohio and two State House Democrats, two legislators, who claim that Jobs Ohio is unconstitutional. And they've tried to take it to court and they've been rebuffed for lack of standing, meaning they do not have they're not vested in this case. They're not the people who should be suing to get the question of constitutionality answered. And that's been their issue all along. And in fact, there is a Tea Party-backed group, the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law, which is an offshoot of the Buckeye Institute, mm-hmm. a conservative group. That group actually joined Progress Ohio in saying, yeah, we want this issue of constitutionality to be resolved, as well as this issue of standing, to find out who can sue. When you have a concern about whether an issue is constitutional or not, can you sue? And so that's really one of the important issues here that the Ohio Supreme Court will decide. And that issue of standing comes in a lot of different cases. I'm thinking of the Ohio Roundtable, this anti-casino gambling group. They sued over the expansion of electronic slot machines into the horse racing tracks, the racinos. They were also turned away, saying they didn't have standing to sue. And so this issue of who can actually sue to find out whether an issue is constitutional is really important.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So I know it's not your bailiwick, Paul, but mm-hmm. the standing is critical after the Supreme Court rules on this one way or the other. Let's say they do have standing. Then it goes back to the district or the appeals court?
Yeah, that's
pleas,
right.
I mean,
and then if they did rule that they did have standing, and really, you know, defining standing is not easy under Ohio law. Essentially, it's going to be something of great public importance. And if they do find that it is of great public importance, they send it back down. Then they can analyze the constitutionality of Jobs Ohio. And there, of course, are a couple of arguments that it isn't constitutional. Jobs Ohio, of course, believes that it is constitutional, that this funding mechanism works and follows the 1851 Constitution. It's interesting that you, as Karen said, you have both conservative group and Progress Ohio both coming out against this and saying that there are problems with Jobs Ohio.
Strange bedfellows indeed.
Indeed. Karen? And but Progress Ohio also was involved with the Ohio Roundtable suit and at least bringing them forward to talk about it. This whole idea of who can sue when there's a question of constitutionality is a big deal on both sides of the political spectrum. And so to finally get the Ohio Supreme Court to make that call and then get this constitutionality question is a big deal, because the last real action we had on this was back when the Jobs Ohio transfer was to be signed, and the members of the Kasich administration all signed it except for Commerce Director David Goodman. And this was a planned stunt, if
this
you want to put it that way.
This is the transfer of the liquor revenue
from the state to Jobs Ohio.
Right, which is a private entity.
It is. And Commerce Director David Goodman made the statement of not signing it, very planned statement, to try to force the Ohio Supreme Court to decide once and for all if this was constitutional or not. And that didn't work. The Ohio Supreme Court didn't get involved then. And so this is really a significant action to try to push all this forward to eventually have a determination once and for all on whether it's constitutional or not.
I said earlier that the amount of the private donations to Jobs Ohio so far is secret, as are the donors of these funds. If the donors to the current funding stream are secret and the use of the funds in part will be secret as well, including the liquor funds, how would we be guaranteed that the donors wouldn't be rewarded with loans down the road? How do we? How, is there anything in the law that protects checks for quid pro quo?
Well, I think the Kasich administration has said several times that there is transparency, that there are annual reports, that there are ways that they're showing that that's not going to happen. But of course, that is always the fear, that when we don't know what's going on, then...
When we don't know who's giving it, we don't know who's getting it.
Right. And that, you know, you have some folks who are saying that this situation with Jobs Ohio is rife for pay to play. We saw how pay to play worked with Tom Noe. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that would set it up, some folks say. But the Kasich administration continues to back up its transparency policies that are in place. So, you know, having a question, though, of whether this is constitutional or not certainly goes some way to trying to decide some of these issues.
And this is just, they're just now getting to the issue of standing.
Yeah.
We don't know when they're going to issue that decision.
Nope.
And then it goes back to the courts to consider the constitutionality. A lot of steps to go. In the meantime, the court's decision to take up the issue of standing caused Jobs Ohio yesterday, I guess, to delay the offering and to update their circular and I guess their sales pitch regarding the bond sale. They want to transfer an estimated $100 million in liquor profits and the sale of the $1.5 billion in bonds would have come from that.
Right. That's right.
What's the next step now? What are they doing now if they've delayed the offering? What does that mean? And
well, I think that they're waiting to see and think about really whether it's the right time to go to market with these bonds. And so if you think about the way that this is supposed to operate, they're getting all this money from the bond investors. What they're going to do with the money is a large amount of that money is going to be used to pay off some existing debt. $100 million is going to Jobs Ohio. $500 million is going into the general budget. Okay, so not all this money from the bond offering is actually going to end up in Jobs Ohio's coffers, just a relatively small percentage of it. So there's more at play here, I think, than just waiting to see whether they can fund Jobs Ohio.
It affects the budget.
It affects the budget.
Absolutely.
That's right. Yeah.
And let me just say,
sure,
it does
Karen.
Affect the budget because there's this kind of one-time payout here from the transfer and the sale here. So that's in, as I understand it, that's now in the rainy day fund. And so, you know, the governor's talking about that there's almost $1 billion in the rainy day fund. This all is all tied together.
It could be, if it's taken a half a year to get to this point, it could easily be.
Right.
Well, and
Who
Jobs
knows?
Ohio
right.
was
how,
one of the governor's
first. I don't
know how
long, first, I mean, with the way the courts move these days.
Jobs Ohio was one of the governor's first
right.
Measures, one of the keystones of his whole
it
first budget.
It kicked off in 2011.
And so this has been a long time coming already. We're at the start of his next budget. So, yeah, this has been out there for a while.
There's a couple of things, thanks to a Plunderbund blog. I saw some of the points in a list of risk factors for investors
right.
if and when these bonds are ever put out there. One of them was the loss of management personnel or management services could have an adverse impact upon the issuer's business and its ability to service the debt, point being that the management of Jobs Ohio and how much they reap from that will depend on whether they can pay the investors.
Yeah, and you know that risk factor I think is actually a fairly typical risk factor that they have in these kinds of bond offerings. The one that's really atypical is the risk that this might be held unconstitutional, and that's really the key issue that they're worried about. If you look at the ratings that were given by Moody's and S&P, Moody's rated this A2, which in their investment grade scale, so these are really the things that most investors actually want to buy and that some investors really only can buy. Some investors are prohibited from buying anything other than investment grade offerings. So A2 is 6 out of 10, I believe, on the Moody's scale. It's not that great of a rating. One of the things that Moody's said in their disclosure about how they rated Jobs Ohio, why they rated it as they did, they said there is uncertainty related to the constitutionality of Jobs Ohio. That was the big issue. And they said, furthermore, our rating could go down if the Supreme Court says that they're going to hear the case. And guess what? They just did last week. So now we're in a position where the rating probably is going to go down. Investors are probably going to be more concerned. I mean, obviously, they're going to be more concerned than they would have been 2 weeks ago about these as investments. So I think that's the major risk factor that that investors are focusing on now.
The change in the top, though, with Mark Kwame leaving and John Minor taking over. Mark Kwame's name was pretty well known.
Sure.
And
yep.
John Minor less so.
That's right.
Does that make a difference, you think?
Sure, it does. It does make a difference. I just don't think that it makes the difference that the constitutionality does, frankly.
Plunderbund also notes that Mark Kwame's name is included multiple times in the attachments to the document. So they may not know yet. Who's
well,
in charge?
They should.
The interim president and chief investment officer of Jobs Ohio.
Yeah, if the market does work efficiently in any way, they're going to be doing their homework.
Hopefully, they should see that Miner's
running it now. I hope that's the case. I would think that that's the case.
So they mentioned the litigation, the outstanding Progress Ohio case. They also mentioned bondholders may have difficulty selling the bonds in any secondary market. Is that pretty boilerplate as well?
It is, but in this case, I think that it makes a more powerful statement simply because of the constitutionality issue that we've been discussing. I mean, that's really going to be something where if they buy them now, okay, and it's later found to be unconstitutional, I mean, how are you going to sell these on a secondary market? It's something that obviously Jobs Ohio, you'd think, would not want to do, but it seems like they are going to go ahead and sell the bonds anyway.
Karen Kassler, we have new members in the Ohio Supreme Court. Anyone know anything enough about the court to know how it might rule on this issue?
Well, you've got folks who are looking at the makeup of the court that's all Republicans, save for one Democrat. And so there's a suspicion. Now, these are justices, though, that they've ruled a variety of ways in a variety of cases. And so I don't think that you can look at the makeup of the court being mostly Republican and automatically assume that this is going to be held constitutional. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a geek. I really think this is going to be a really interesting argument here once it actually gets not just the standing argument, because that affects, I think, a lot of other cases, like I mentioned, you know, some of these other issues. But I think this whole argument of whether it's constitutional or not, this is, to me, kind of historic, that you've got a state agency, a public-private partnership that was created by the legislature that now could be argued might be unconstitutional. I think that's amazing, and I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. Just to add on to that just a little bit, I mean, Karen's absolutely right. I think if you look at what other states have done, Ohio's not the first state to think of this kind of a public-private partnership. A number of other states have done it. The difference with Ohio is that Ohio actually has provisions in its constitution, articles, that seem to prohibit the very thing that Jobs Ohio does, arguably. So it will really be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, maybe we gather again in the future and talk about it again.
Oh, I hope so.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Karen Kassler, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here.
Karen Kassler is the Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and also Paul Rose. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Paul is an Associate Professor of Law at the Moritz College of Law at OSU. Coming up, we're going to look at homelessness in Central Ohio. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Neil Conan. Here on Talk of the Nation, we learn a lot about our guests, like journalist Bob Woodward, who noticed that we really like to listen to our callers.
You do these calls, you put the caller on, and leave them on.
Even Woodward's been shuffled off other programs.
Anyone been a dumped caller?
Have your say and a follow-up on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. It's 54 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today and warm, a high of 62. Some rain is likely tonight, a low of 57. Rain, maybe a thunderstorm on Wednesday with temperatures reaching 61 degrees, then falling to 51 throughout the day. Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, performing with the Columbus Youth Jazz Orchestra in Ragtime Blues and Beyond, A Short History of Jazz, with guest saxophonist Tina Fuller and drummer Lewis Nash, showcasing over 100 years of jazz. February 7th through the 10th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues right here on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back. Last week, the Community Shelter Board counted the homeless in Central Ohio, but they tried something different this year to fulfill the annual federally mandated task. Joining us now to talk about that is Michelle Heritage, Executive Director of the Community Shelter Board. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
So you changed tack this year for the annual count. Mm-hmm. Instead of spreading out, fanning out across the city, you asked homeless people to come to you at Veterans Memorial. Why the change?
Well, what we decided was we wanted to make some changes in the count because we wanted to see if we could pick up some specific populations that we felt may be undercounted. Those populations being transitional age youth, which is youth 18 to 24, and also even youth under 18, teenagers that may be experiencing homelessness and on the street. And also women. We know that we don't tend to find women out in the camps very often or sleeping on the street, but that doesn't mean they're not experiencing homelessness.
You already count the shelter populations automatically, right?
Absolutely. HUD requires us during the last 10 days of January, during a 24-hour period, to make a homeless count. And so we have traditionally fanned out on the streets in the middle of the night and counted folks that are in the camps and on the street, and at the same time done that in our shelters, getting our shelter count from our data. This year, what we did was held an event down at Veterans Memorial, and we wanted to see if we could get people to come in and also answer some survey questions to find out how long they've been experiencing homelessness. We had about 50 providers that came down to Veterans with us, which was absolutely excellent, that could provide services immediately for folks coming through the doors, including some very basic needs. For example, mobile outreach was there in the Mount Carmel Health Van. We had people coming in with frostbite and really significant issues, having problems medicating themselves with their seizure disorders. And they were able to get services right there. We had food, clothing, and a whole plethora of providers that are able to help you end your homelessness. So it was really twofold. We were wanting to count more folks, and we were also wanting to get those services to them right away.
If you have questions or comments about the annual homeless count, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can tweet us at @WOSUAllSides. Why winter for the annual count? Because people are more likely to come forward when it's cold outside, or is it just because it's the top of the year?
We do it in the winter because what we know is that we tend to have more people in shelter during the winter time. We actually open an overflow site that serves almost 200 extra people, and then our other seven shelters all expand their walls to accommodate additional folks that may need shelter from the cold.
And that'll be automatically counted then.
So that makes that count a little bit easier. And then for the folks that are remaining out on the street or in the camps, there are less people to have to count and be out there. This year, even though we had the daytime count and had folks coming into Veterans, we still had teams of people all throughout the street, in the camps, at the various soup kitchens and community kitchens, and also a youth team out there trying to help our youth be counted.
I know you're not going to have the final counts right away, but do you have a sense about whether or not you achieved that goal of attracting those special populations, the transitional age youth and 18 and younger, and the women?
We do not know that quite yet. We haven't tallied the results, so I really don't know the breakdowns of genders yet. What we do know is over 300 folks showed up at Veterans Memorial. We know we'll have more numbers coming in from folks who were doing our street counts and out in the camps. We did find a handful of those 18 to 24-year-old youth, and we're able to link them immediately with folks. We also had a great thing happen where some folks who had been out in the woods and in the camps for many years, chronically homeless, came into Vets Memorial, and we were able to link them immediately with services even doing disability assessments to get them on lists for supportive housing. That was a really good thing to have those services right there.
I read Rita Price's article in the Dispatch the other day about this, and she wrote about a fellow who had a pet. And it made me wonder how often are pets part of the equation?
You know, I have witnessed this myself. I go out to the camps every so often just to, frankly, speak with folks directly and ask them, what's going on? How come you're out here? And pets is one of the reasons why people are out there. And I know that our Humane Society is willing to set up for folks to have their pets go in and be kept for free. And once they get housed, they can come out. But there's a lot of just distrust of surrendering your pet. Another population is couples. We don't have any shelters right now for couples. And, if you're in a long-term relationship and you're both experiencing homelessness, it's really terrifying to think of you going to one shelter and someone else going to another. And as we look at redesigning our adult single system, which is what we're in the middle of right now, we really have to address these needs of couples and of pets. And some communities have done it. Miami's got an animal shelter that is actually tied next to their homeless shelter so that the pets can be right there and you can see them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the homeless in Central Ohio. If you have a question or comment, still with me, Michelle Heritage. She's Executive Director of the Community Shelter Board. And joining us now is Elfie DiBella. She's President of the YWCA Columbus, which operates shelters for single women and one for families. Right, Elfie?
That's correct.
Yes, welcome
indeed.
To the show.
Thank you very much.
So when we talk about families, that's different than couples.
Absolutely.
What's the difference?
The challenges are multifold. But once you have children, it just really changes the equation altogether. And so where the family center comes in, it provides emergency shelter, but also critical services to stabilize the families. We not only provide a warm meal and warm bed, but we also surround them with services to help the parents get a job, get housing, whatever the needs are. And we have a wonderful relationship with Project Connect, so the school-aged children will stay in their school of origin, and we have a safe and sound child care, which is an accredited child care, where our little ones will be taken care of so our parents can take care of what they need to take care to once move on again.
And I know the majority of parents are single mothers, but there are families, a mother and father,
Absolutely.
Or whatever the makeup of the family, they can all go to this one.
Yes, yes. It does not matter if it's a single male or female head of household. We also have dual head of households. But an alarming trend that we continue to see is that 70% of our families are headed by a single head of household, single female head of household.
And those heads of households, what we're finding in our community is that 60% of those heads of households are under the age of 30. You compare that with 22% nationally. We have a really significant overrepresentation of very, very young parents who are experiencing homelessness, and usually they have children under the age of 7 as well.
And she's absolutely right. 51% of our children will be under the age of 5 or younger, as well as we have one-third of our families will have a parent between the age of 18 and 24.
When we talk about homeless, let's make sure we're all talking about the same thing. Are we talking about people who don't have their own place? They may be sleeping on somebody's couch, but they don't have their own home? Or is it homeless somebody who really is absolutely out on the street, if not for the shelters?
We are using a very strict definition of homelessness, and that means literally homeless. So, but for the shelter, they would be on the street. There are a lot of folks in our community and across the nation because of the economy that are in a doubled up situation. They're staying with friends or family. And we also know that young folks, adolescents that are homeless, and young adults, 18, 19, 20 years old, tend to do what we call couch surfing. They're going from couch to couch, and we're really trying to locate them because we know that if we can intervene early with them, we can prevent them from hopefully being on a track where they have chronic homelessness or repeat episodes of homelessness.
You can give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And David in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome, David.
Yes, hello. Like to know what is the obstacle for these people to be homeless, live in the cold, be apart from society, And why aren't we delivering that so they can come in out of the cold? And I'd like the opportunity to follow up if possible.
Okay, well, let's see. Michelle?
Sure. The main cause of homelessness, I will give you two main causes of homelessness, and that is, number one, no job. It is very, very difficult to obtain employment that is a living wage. Right now, for example, for a market rate apartment, a minimum wage earner needs to work about 52 hours a week, every single week of the year, without a break, to be able to afford a market rate apartment. And so living wage work is a real huge challenge. If you've got any barriers, which can include credit problems, eviction history, or any kind of criminal background, it becomes exponentially harder. So it's a pretty straight line, no job, no home. The second is the lack of affordable housing. Even though our community has really enjoys a great market for housing, both rental and housing ownership, there are not enough places where people can rent that the rent is at a level that they can afford. For our families, for example, coming into the family center, their monthly income is under $400 on average. And so we need more affordable housing. Those are really two of the top barriers to keep people in homelessness and also how they end up becoming homeless.
And two additional challenges we see is the lack of transportation, as well as the lack of affordable and non-traditional times for childcare. A lot of our parents have second and third shifts, and you cannot find childcare.
Which brings me to another question about children. Do we know whether children are out on the streets and meaning sleeping in cars, sleeping in, that are still homeless despite what the shelter offers?
Well, I'll take that one, and then Elfie can too. This community, which is, I believe, one of the greatest communities in this country, and why I enjoy so much living here and working here, has made a commitment to families that no family will ever be on the street homeless. And so if we have found a family on the street, usually they ended up there because they didn't know about the resources. And this is where our outreach teams bring them in. Our service providers and our elected officials and other leaders in the community are very aware that we have this commitment that no family will be on the street homeless. And so we will be called immediately as soon as someone is located. And the YWCA, which is a national model for this work, is able to expand their walls flexibly. So if a family presents, they are able to make room for them or other accommodations to make sure that they are not on the street.
In December, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced that while the nation's homeless numbers decreased in 2012, Ohio reported a 7.3% increase. And I was wondering if your expectations are along those lines in Central Ohio. And it's hard to believe, given that Ohio is being held up as a national example of economic recovery.
Sure. Well, here's a couple of things we're experiencing. You know, we've seen those new poverty reports come out. And unfortunately, Columbus is leading. And so we're seeing a disparity in kind of recovery happening in some sectors, but not for those folks that are really maybe have been hanging on at the edge even prior to the recession. And so those very high poverty numbers in our community are really the canary in the coal mine for homelessness. And, you know, the same thing with food insecurity and that kind of thing. We can continue to see the numbers climb in our community and all sectors, especially concerning us this year, as we saw a real steady number go up on women who are experiencing homelessness at around 22% over last year.
Tell us about what you do at the YWCA for single women, Elfie.
Well, at the YWCA, we do have a women's residency program, and that is for formerly homeless women. They may have a combination of mental illness, drug abuse, or a combination of all. And we house these women, pardon me, and provide them with 24-hour services, and we provide them opportunities to get their life back together, to get a job, to eventually move on. But we also help them get their GEDs. We help them stay off drugs or stay on their medication. So really have that permanent supportive housing that is so important to really help them get back on their feet.
Getting back to that younger group, the Community Shelter Board has been working with West Coast Shelters, I read, to learn how to better serve that demographic. What's happening at the West Coast Shelters that you want to learn more about?
Well, the West Coast is what we call a destination runaway city. And so as great as Columbus is, when young folks think about maybe leaving, either because they've been, you know, runaways or throwaways, meaning, you know, they've had to leave home for whatever reasons, the West Coast is a place where they want to go, and there's a corridor that runs from L.A. all the way up through Seattle. There's actually a train line that allows young folks to kind of get up and down there. So their street population, specifically of young folks that are experiencing homelessness, teenagers, all the way through, you know, our early 20s, is very, very high compared to what we have. So that means that they are ahead of us in many of the strategies that they have developed and are using and already tested in order to be able to really meet the needs of this population, which is not the same kinds of needs that, for example, maybe a 50-year-old person who's experiencing homelessness has. So we've been doing technical assistance with them, Seattle and Los Angeles specifically, to really learn about the ways they're going about things. And we actually have got some national research out right now where we have asked our research firm, Apt Associates, which is a national leading firm about homelessness, to tell us what the best practices are, and we need to begin to insert these practices. I think this is one place where Columbus is not the national model. Where we really need to do a much better job is with these transitional age youth.
Often they are youth who have aged out of the foster care system. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what exactly the percentage is, but I know that Franklin County Children's Services has been working for some years now to remedy that and create kind of some kind of purpose in their lives, whether it's college or going forward. Have you noticed, do you work with them at all on that score?
We do. Children's Services has been at the table with us, and I will have to say we have an excellent Children's Services. In many communities, Children's Services does not work with other providers and other systems to prevent this from happening, but our Children's Services is really doing a great job. What we see, though, is because of the recession and because of folks experiencing high levels of poverty, young folks are leaving, and they don't have any resources at all. So it's not just that they're aging out of foster care or residential treatment. They may be aging out of a very impoverished family that does not have resources to offer them. And for any of us like me who have older teenagers, I have a 19-year-old son, I'm not sure what would happen to him if I wasn't here to provide additional resources and guidance for him. Some families just don't have that available to them, which means that we need to think about building out those kinds of resources. Studies have shown that if we do not catch this population early on, get them employed, get them linked into kind of mainstream work and all these things, that we literally will end up growing the next chronically homeless population down the road.
We are going to take a break right now. We're talking about homeless in Central Ohio with Michelle Heritage, Executive Director of the Community Shelter Board. Also, Elfie DiBella, President of the YWCA of Columbus. Coming up, we're going to hear from the Columbus Veterans Administration. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how the U.S. military came to embrace counterinsurgency as an approach to the fighting in Iraq and why it's failed in Afghanistan. We'll talk with journalist and historian Fred Kaplan, author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. And stay with us at 11 o'clock for Tech Tuesday and a discussion of Android actors with Chuck Helm from the OSU Wexner Center for the Arts. Join us for Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon. Cloudy skies today, a high of 62, rain for tonight, a low of 57, and rain, maybe a thunderstorm on Wednesday, with temperatures reaching 61 degrees, then falling to about 51 throughout the day. A chance of a rain-snow mix Wednesday night, with a low of 25. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
The weather outside for a few days at least is not frightful. It's supposed to get up in the 60s today. Not bad for late January, especially if you are forced to sleep outside at night. We're talking about strategies to help the homeless change that status. Still with us is Michelle Heritage of the Community Shelter Board and Elfie DeBella of the YWCA. And joining us now to talk about an important subset of the homeless population is Adam Riggi of the Columbus Veterans Administration. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Elfie, I wanted to just get back to the family shelter for just a minute. You've seen huge increases in the population there.
Yes, indeed we have. Over the last 2 years alone, we have seen an increase of about 52%. When you look back at the last 4 years, it's a 70% increase of the families that we serve with our family at our family centers. It's truly distressing and disturbing.
It reflects the economy, though, but again, there's not been any ebbing of this as the economy's improved.
No, we truly think that this might be for the next few years, the new norm. On a daily average basis, we have about 82 families. We're 132% capacity. And so that is challenging, as you can imagine. There's a lot of wear and tear on the building, on the staff, and on the families themselves. And that, Michelle mentioned it earlier, we do have a decrease in income, and that is hurting our families to move on.
They're mostly working then.
Absolutely. Many families or parents will have a job when they come live with us, but if not, when we help them get one. So it is, there are some challenges out there, and that continued, after effects of the recession still hurting these families.
Because there's children involved, the services are a bit different. What's different about the family shelter from other shelters for adults only?
Sure. When you have children, so many other factors come into it, whether it's be education, whether it's health care. Your parents need to know that they can be out and about to get their life back together, to get the job and so forth. We are an Ohio Benefit Bank site, as the YWCA Family Center is. So we can connect the parents to all the services, food stamps and so forth that they need. We have a child care on site. We have a great connection with Project Connect, so the school-aged children will stay in their school of origin. But we also partner with a multitude of different nonprofit organizations who come on a regular basis and give our children health care checkups in that component. We truly could not do this work without the help of our partner agencies.
How often do you find that people, by the time they wind up in your shelter, don't already know about food stamps?
You'd be surprised. Mm-hmm. About 40 to 60% of the families we see have never been homeless, do not know how to navigate the system. So that's where our family advocates come in, because within 24 hours, we surround our families with the necessary skill set of what they need to do to move on. We create a goal plan, and they know exactly what they need to do in order to move out. And when you think about it, the average family, despite the large numbers that we serve, moves on between 21 and 26 days, when the national average is about 64 night stay in a shelter as ours. So can't say enough about our community, our staff, and the family center and what we do here to address the issue of homeless families.
And I'll say one thing about, too, the adult system. And as I've said, the YWCA is a national model. People literally fly in from all over the country to see the work that's being done there and in the entire family system. It is an excellent system, and it runs very well, and they're able to, in spite of all the things we've talked about, house families at a very high rate, and very rare does a family return. Under 10% chance a family's going to come back. And they do not have enough resources, so let me state that. But the single adult system has even less ability to get resources. And there is a stigma that surrounds folks experiencing homelessness, especially men. And the ability for our providers to do the kinds of services that need to be done to end homelessness is very, very challenged by that, because of some of the stigma that's involved in that and really needing more resources to get people back off their feet. The great news of the day is we do know what to do. If we have the resources to do it, we can end people's homelessness. And that's the one thing I want everyone to know. Homelessness is not an intractable issue. It's not something that has to be in our community and continue to exist in our community. We absolutely can do something about this.
I've read where you think we can make homelessness go away.
I do.
And you really believe that.
I do.
It seems almost impossible that we've grown up with this now, that this is part of the tapestry of our society. And you don't think it has to be?
No, absolutely not. If you think about it, homelessness is a fairly recent kind of thing that's happened. It's really started sort of in the mid to late 80s is when we really began to see homelessness occur. And so I think we think it's been around forever and there's no way to stop it, but mm-hmm. that's not true. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't going to be people that lose their homes and have housing crisis and those kinds of things, but I'm talking about we do not have to have people who live on the streets and have long-term intractable homelessness or have long stays in shelters. That is absolutely not necessary. We can move to getting people housed and rehoused very quickly with stable supports. We've shown we can do it. It's absolutely a possibility. So, yeah, I believe in my heart and soul. And you know, though, that when you talk to me and anybody talks to me for very long, two minutes or more, I'm going to tell you we can end homelessness and this community will be the first place to do it.
Adam Riggi from the Columbus Veterans Administration, there is some good news for you guys when it comes to the homeless veterans count in Central Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely. Over the past few years, actually, we've seen a reduction in the number of homeless veterans during our point in time counts. And even when there's reports out looking at the year-long report. So we've seen major reductions. Since 2009, the VA has actually made it a major initiative to end homelessness among veterans in the U.S. And here in Franklin County, we've actually received quite a few resources in terms of outreach and prevention services to reach out to veterans who are on the streets or in jails or, you know, under bridges in the shelters mm-hmm. to prevent them from becoming homeless in the first place through linkages with some of our community partner agencies. We've also more recently in the last 4 years started providing housing through a program called the HUD-VASH program, which is actually a Section 8 voucher program that takes chronically homeless veterans, either who are in the shelter or on the streets, takes them and puts them immediately into housing. So with treatment services while they're in housing. So there's been a major expansion since 2009, and we've seen the outcomes. We have seen it in our shelter system. We've seen it in our unsheltered counts. We've seen major reductions in the numbers of veterans who are actually sleeping outside in tents. We've made it a major priority to get every veteran that lives here in Central Ohio who's living in a tent or on the streets, off the streets, and into safe and affordable housing.
I was going to ask you what tactics you've used that might translate to the general homeless population. Do I get it that it's more resources?
Resources.
Okay.
But here's a perfect example. First of all, we have a veterans partner in our community, which is an excellent partner and have been for many, many, many years. Very progressive in their thinking and absolutely adamant in the way that they're going about this. This is a national push from the Veterans Administration, and it shows that when you have folks that work together and the resources come into a community and you are absolutely on a mission to end veteran homelessness, which I think we are by 2015 is the goal, that you can see it. And we can see this decline in veteran homelessness in our own community from the work that's been going on that Adam's helping to lead.
But Columbus or Central Ohio has done better than most.
National data suggested last year that the number of unsheltered veterans actually increased, and for us, we actually decreased. Now, the one thing I really want to point out is that the thing that veterans have that a lot of the general homeless population don't have as much access to is health care. VA provides full services, for health care services, primary care, mental health services, specialty care services. So when we identify a veteran who may be living out in a camp, not only can we get them in housing, we can actually get them into free, affordable health care as well. And that follows them from the point they get into housing and throughout their whole lives. In addition, we try to get them jobs too. So our goal isn't just housing, mm-hmm. but get them health care, get them healthy, get them jobs.
So how often, Elfie, DeBella, do you find that a family is forced into a shelter situation because of medical bills?
It happens quite a bit. As you can imagine, with every family has a different story, but yet it does happen. It's truly the working poor. You know, it's that one medical bill that sends you over the cliff, or you have a job and then you lose it. The company's downsized. So we're seeing that quite a bit.
And I think I interviewed a woman at the single women's shelter at the Y a few years back who it was medical bills that forced
Absolutely.
Her. She couldn't get the health care she needed, and she couldn't afford it anymore.
That's correct.
We're also finding, because of lack of preventive care and lack of insurance to get people care that would prevent conditions, that folks are coming into shelter very sick. and in ways that they don't need to be as sick as they are. And so, you know, cancer that's very late stage, heart disease that is just absolutely could have been prevented down the line with, you know, a drug they took every day that wasn't that expensive. And so you see that happening too. You know, a chronically homeless person's life expectancy is 63 years. You know, for the rest of us, we're starting to push up on 80, just to kind of show you how tough that is. And a lot of that has to do with just the health conditions not being treated at a time when they would have been a lot better to treat because more effective, and it sure would have cost a lot less money.
And another symptom that we see is that they can't afford the medical or the medicine they need to take for their mental illness. Mm-hmm. And so you have this vicious cycle of, you know, losing your job or losing your housing because you can't afford the medicine that you need to take to be stabilized.
Right. Ted in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ted. Hi, Ted.
How you doing? I really appreciate your show today, listening. I am a volunteer, rare volunteer, but occasional volunteer at the YWCA Family Center. I think it's a fantastic facility, and we've had nothing but positive experiences. We even took our grandchildren there to help serve meals in the evening. The way that they do it, with having a different church or a different organization there, coming in and providing meals in the evenings is a wonderful experience. It helps you to understand what people are going through. I go back to where it used to be Hope in Church, and it was a lot of single guys. That stigma was there. And we used to just put people up in hotel rooms and spend $300 to $500 a night per church. And I always thought, what if we build a building, or what if somebody just built a big facility? And it happened without my help, of course. But nevertheless, I just want to say thank you to the folks that are working there and helping these homeless people.
All right. Ted, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
We have an email from Matthew in Upper Arlington. He asks, could you ask your guests what an ordinary person like myself can do to help? Donations, Habitat for Humanity, where could I volunteer? What is the most impactful thing I could do? Now, Ted gave us one example of something you could do. Elfie, any suggestions?
Of course, yes. Certainly volunteering at the Family Center is a tremendous gift to us. We're heavily volunteer-driven, and every dinner and meal is paid for and served by volunteers. That's a savings of about $200,000 to the YWCA on an annual basis. Very important to us. It's a great way to give back. There are other volunteer opportunities. Certainly fundraisers are very important. We just can leverage a dollar so much more effectively than you could imagine. We're also, unfortunately, now seeing families who are walking in with children who have no socks, no shoes, no coats. So we are in a desperate need for new clothing off those items. But we do have a website, and there's wonderful opportunities to be part of this, whether you volunteer your time or whether you volunteer your financial resources. It's so important for us.
Yeah, we'll post the websites for the YWCA, the Community Shelter Board, and Columbus Veterans Administration on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. An email from Allison in Columbus. Adam Riggi, you might have already answered this, but she asks, is there a need for help with the homeless count at Vets Memorial? Are citizens able to volunteer to help? Has anyone contacted the National Guard about soldiers helping with this? Because you do have, is it Stand Down?
Yes, we have Stand Down every October,
okay. Mm-hmm.
Which is a one-day kind of homeless resources fair for veterans. We typically see about 250 veterans there during that day. Mm-hmm. And that and the Stand Down is a wonderful opportunity to volunteer. We're always looking for volunteers to be a part of that.
Okay, so they can get a hold of the Columbus Veterans Administration and help out with that there.
And if you want to volunteer for the point in time count, which will be January of next year, you want to contact Community Shelter Board, Aaron Moss.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Check that out. We'll have the contact information at our website again at WOSU.org/allsides. I wanted to get to an issue about the transitional group again. It's the kind of the group you're struggling with. Elfie, are you certain or do you know if it's the case that some families are coming to the shelter with their younger children, but their older children don't want to go there and are bunking at someone else? That's where that kind of split up begins.
We see a lot of different.
They're embarrassed.
We see a lot of different combinations. We actually see moms who have an adult aged daughter living with them, and then little ones as well. And sometimes it's a blended family where mom has little babies as well as the adult daughter who is with her. So those are the challenges that are happening. And especially when you have that little bit of element of some mental illness, it really makes it hard. So, yeah, it's a combination, truly, and every family will have a different combination.
We had an email from Christina, and she wanted to ask about the homeless and the relationship between mental illness, and we've kind of already talked about that, but she also asked about those suffering from conditions like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and wondered about that. Adam, do you want to speak to that a little bit? Because there's a high incidence of that from the Afghanistan and Iraq wars.
And there is. Among the homeless veteran population, there's a much higher prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder from military experience, but also life on the street. And what we're able to do is provide mental health services to those veterans in the form of psychotherapy or psychiatry or social work assistance to help them kind of cope with the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, the other issue is around traumatic brain injury, and I think this impacts the homeless population in general because of the higher prevalence of traumatic brain injury. So we're because of our healthcare system, we're able to provide those services through the Columbus VA to help them overcome those challenges.
And this is a distinct difference, as Adam pointed out, between what's available for non-veterans. And so for folks especially who have experienced multiple episodes of homelessness or chronically homeless, meaning for a very long time, we do see higher incidence of both drug and alcohol use and mental illness. But the community does not have enough services to help people get treatment for those challenges. And so then it's this kind of vicious cycle of, you know, staying homeless, as Elfie said, because you can't afford the medicine that keeps you stabilized, or you can't get into treatment. You don't want to use anymore, but you just can't get into treatment, or the waiting list is long. So it just really points up that when we make the commitments, like the Veterans Administration has, to provide those services, that you can make those numbers decline pretty quickly. We've seen just in a very short time frame of about 3 years, those numbers of homeless veterans have begun to go down and down and down. And so they're a great model for what's possible, and also a model for what works.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask quickly about transportation issues. I know it's a really big problem for people who are in rural areas. What about, Elfie, what about the folks at your place? Because do you provide parking if they happen to have a vehicle?
Yes, indeed, we do provide parking. But as you can imagine, the majority of our families will not have a car. By the time they come to us, they may have lived in the car at some point in time, but they will not be able to afford a car. So they're heavily reliant on Dakota bus transportation. And we actually have a wonderful relationship with COTA where we can buy for a reduced rate, but it is something that we pay for, and then we hand out the bus passes so our families can continue to go to their work. They can continue to go, you know, find a job, go on job interviews, go, you know, try to find housing. It's a tremendous cost to us, as you can imagine, but it's something we need to do to so our families can successfully leave us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you're looking for a way to help the homeless in Central Ohio, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll be posting the websites for the Community Shelter Board. And Michelle Heritage, Executive Director of the Community Shelter Board, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Also, Elfie DeBella, President of YWCA Columbus. Elfie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Adam Riggi, he's a member of the Columbus Veterans Administration. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 MPR News.